We're running a little bit early, which is not a bad thing, really. So I guess we'll just start at this time instead of 4 o'clock. And now we have Russell Cocker, and he will explain SE Linux policies. Thanks.
Okay, just a brief disclaimer before I get started properly. I'm going to cover some very technical and demanding aspects of writing policy. Don't be scared, because most of you will never ever have to do the kind of things I'm talking about. If you're using the targeted policy, a lot of the things I'll discuss won't apply to targeted policy. And even if you're working on the strict policy, I'll be coming to the more advanced aspects, which a lot of you won't need to cover. So don't be scared if there's some parts where you find a bit too demanding, because usually when writing policy, you're doing small tweaks to policies that's already been written, not writing entirely new policy on your own, and not working on some of the more difficult areas like the mail server policy. Okay, I'll just give you a quick overview of what the policy does in Linux. It defines the types for some objects and for processes, defines the roles that are used for constraining the domains that may be used for processes, defines identities that users may have assigned to the process when they log in, defines the relations between identities, roles, and domains which are used to constrain access, and of course has a huge set of rules determining which actions are permitted and which actions will be audited. By default, nothing's permitted, so every operation that you want to permit on your system, you have a specific allow rule for. This isn't as hard as you might think, because the default policy allows most of the things you want it to allow, so you need to make small tweaks to it normally. So normally when you're writing policy, there's just two types of operations you might want to do. One is small tweaks, which is perhaps allowing a daemon to access an extra file, or defining a new user role or a new user identity for the policy. This is fairly simple stuff. And the other type is to define a new domain for a daemon. So perhaps you're running a daemon that isn't in common use, and therefore there's no policy written for it, or you're running a daemon that's a proprietary program only used in your company, and it's not open source, so therefore no one has had a possibility of writing policy for it before. This is probably the hardest thing most of you will ever do, is writing policy for a new daemon, which isn't that hard as far as policy writing goes. The policy is loaded in the kernel at boot time by the init process, so a binary policy is loaded by init. It has to have been previously compiled and installed in the correct place that the init will look for it. And the complete operation of the system is determined by the policy and the type labeling of the file systems, which is part of the policy definition. Okay, I've got some stats here on the size of the policy for Fedora Core 2. I haven't bothered updating the stats for Fedora Core 3 and Fedora Core 4 test releases, because the actual exact numbers don't really matter that much. I'm just trying to give you an overview of the scale of it. So the numbers are about 30% bigger for Fedora Core 3 and Fedora Core 4, but it's just the overall scale that's the issue. So the default Fedora Core 2 policy is about 300,000 rules. Minimum policy might have as little as 80,000 rules. Rules in this case means the rules in the binary form. So it means a specific relationship between the domain and type. In the source form, you might use attributes to reference groups of domains or groups of types. In that case, one line in the policy source may expand to 100 or 1,000 lines in the binary form. In the strict policy, there needs to be a specific policy file for each daemon, defining what the daemon is permitted to do. In the targeted policy, you have some daemons running in the unconfined domain. There are two reasons for running daemons in the unconfined domain. One is that you might have no great need seen for writing the policy for it, and the daemon might not be a very common daemon. Another reason is daemons where you have configuration choices that put them outside the range of the default policy, and for which you lack the skills or the time to modify the policy for them. One example of this is Apache. Apache is a very configurable daemon, and there's an infinite number of ways of configuring it. And the standard policy for Apache only covers the most common implementations of Apache. So many people want to run Apache in ways that we haven't planned for, and that we can't make the standard policy work with. There are some booleans to change the operation of the Apache policy, but even those booleans don't quite cover the range of things that people want to do with Apache. So many people don't have the skills or the inclination to write policy themselves, we have an option of running Apache in the unconfined domain, which effectively means turning off SE Linux as control for Apache, so Apache can do anything that it wants. This is, of course, a security issue, because if Apache or any of the important programs it executes, such as SUXEC, was to have a security hole, then that could compromise your entire system. This is a choice you make as a user. You decide that when you're running your system that you haven't got the time to adjust the Apache policy to fully match your needs, and yet you need to run Apache in a way that is outside the default configuration, and then you find your only option in that case is to disable SE Linux access control on Apache. It's not something you want to do, it's not something we recommend doing if there's an alternative, but we recognise the fact that for some people they feel like they've got no other option, and it's better than turning off SE Linux entirely, which is what other people are doing instead. Incidentally, running Apache in the unconfined domain is only an option for the target policy. It's sort of assumed that if you're running a strict policy, then you've got the necessary skills and time to make minor adjustments to the policy files as needed. Now, in Fedora Core 2, the M4 macro version of the policy, as before it's run through M4, is at 23,000 lines. So it's expanded greatly by the M4 macro processing. And the output of M4 processing is about 200,000 lines. So it goes from 23,000 lines before macro processing to 200,000 after macro processing, and then 300,000 lines, or 300,000 binary rules. Now the output of M4 processing is a file that's by default called policy.conf, which is then compiled by a check policy program to the binary form that kernel understands. The number of rules in the binary policy is partly due to the fact that one rule in the source of the policy, be it an allow rule, a don't audit rule, or an audit allow rule, one rule can correspond to many rules in the binary policy. So you can refer to a group of domains acting on a group of types, and therefore you have the number of binary rules equal to number of domains multiplied by number of types. So you have allow a group of 100 domains to access a group of 100 types, and therefore get 10,000 binary rules. Another possibility, of course, when you're compiling a policy is if you have several rules in the policy source that just refer to the same combination of domain and type, they'll be combined into one rule in the binary policy. In the binary policy, there is only one entry for each combination of domain, type, and object class. Object class being file, directory, or whatever other type of objects are being accessed. Now, we've got two different policies that have two quite different aims. The strict policy aims to give the absolute minimum privileges to every program, and we recognise that this means making some compromises for usability. So we know that running strict policy won't be as easy as running a non-SE Linux machine or a machine with targeted policy, but we believe this is like what a lot of people want to do. It's what I use for my machines. I recently gave a talk at the SE Linux Symposium in Washington, and talking to the audience afterwards, it seemed that most people in the audience were interested in strict policy. So these are people who have fairly demanding needs for security, mainly a large portion from the US government and defense contractors. So they have more needs for security than probably most of you would have, and therefore for them, strict policy was not one they wanted to go for. Targeted policy, on the other hand, is mainly aimed at usability, and we realise that with targeted policy, we won't be as restrictive as we would like to have. There are some things that were permitted that we prefer not to permit, but we have to make it as usable as possible. I believe that these aims are worthwhile. My estimation is that there are over 3 million people using targeted policy in Fedora Core 3 who don't even know they're using SE Linux. The machine just works the same way as Fedora Core 2 used to work, and Fedora Core 1, etc. And they don't know they're using SE Linux, they don't bother about it. Programs work the way they want them to work, and they're happy. And they might notice some future time, if they don't apply security patches, that one of their daemons has been dumping core a lot and logging some messages, if they read their logs. If they don't, maybe the machine will just be protected without even knowing about it. So the aim of tag policy is to lock down the things in lockdown the most. So you have daemons that are network facing and need to be locked down, and we have no restrictions on user login sessions, as opposed to the strict policy where every user login session is restricted, even the administrators log in, and programs you run from your login session may run in different security contexts to restrict their access. For example, ISE clients have a bad security history, so we have a special domain for text mode IRC clients to prevent them doing a variety of operations, including access to regular files, to make it harder for someone who's running an IRC server or using DCC to compromise your IRC client and exploit your system by it. Okay, now I'll just cover the policy syntax for SE Linux. Firstly, one of the core syntax rules is to define an attribute. And so that's the attribute keyword followed by the name of the attribute and a semicolon. An attribute can be used for grouping type declarations. So it's a group of either types or domains. And so it's just used effectively like a macro to refer to multiple types of domains. Also, it can refer to zero types, and that's a valid syntax. So sometimes you're writing policy, you write policy that interacts with policy written by another person or policy defined in another file, and you don't know whether the other bit of policy will be there or not. So you might permit access to a file type, whereas you might know that the policy might be changed and the other file type might not necessarily exist. If you reference the file type and the file type doesn't exist, it's an impaler. If you reference the attribute, and the attribute just happens to map to zero file types, that's fine. That bit of policy just gets compiled out. Now some of the common attributes, there's attribute domain for processes. So domain, so applying the domain attribute on a type declaration is what separates the declaration of a type for a process versus a type for a file. The file underscore type is the attribute that specifies identifies all files and objects, so it's files, directories, symbolic links, etc. Sysadm file is the files the administrator may write to. That's a subset of the types specified in the file type attribute. Port type is for network ports, generally TCP and UDP ports. Device type is for device nodes, so it's everything under /dev. And user domain is an attribute that applies to all domains that may be used for a user login session. This isn't all domains the user process may enter. There are many domains that aren't in this. This is only for the domains that may be used for the initial login session. So that is the first process spawned on their behalf by a XDM type program, an SSHD, or /bin/login. Now we would define a type. Syntax is the keyword type, then the name of the type you're defining, and then a list of zero or more attributes. In almost any policy that you would write, if you write policy that defines a type with no attributes, you're doing the wrong thing. You should have some attributes to at least identify whether it's a type that applies to a process or a regular file on disk or a port. So some examples are, if you're defining a domain for a process, you have type, the name of the daemon for a daemon domain, _t, and then comma, and then the attribute domain. And example for port type, you might have type, DNS port type, _t, for the DNS port type, and then the port type attribute. And then for a typical file type, you would define the name of the file type, then you have the attributes file type and sysadm file. In almost every case where you define a type for a file, you give both file type and sysadm file attributes, because in almost every bit of policy you'll write, you'll want the administrator to be able to edit the file. There's only a few files that the administrator might not be granted full access to. One of which is the shadow file, shadow_t. Now, in the current policies, there's two types that are declared that don't have attributes, for proc kmessage and proc kcore. These are exceptions, a little different to the types used everywhere else. Generally, I'd say you should never be writing policy that doesn't have attributes. And even in those cases, we might go back and change things to add attributes to those. Now, to permit an access, the keyword is allow to allow an access. You can specify that the name of a domain that is to be granted the access, the name of a type that the domain we used to access, then a colon, then the name of the object class, those are the type of object being accessed, and then the operation operations. So we've got two examples here. First one is allow the mount underscore t domain, that's the domain for the mount program, access to file underscore type, which means every type that applies to regular file on a regular file system, object class directory, and access search. So that means if you want to mount a file system under /usr/lib or whatever it is, you can be sure that the mount program can search through those directories to be able to find the mount point. Now, second operation, allow mount underscore t access to file underscore t. File underscore t is a special type that refers to a file that has not been labeled. This is the file that was created when the machine was not running SE Linux. And so an access grant to this is for the object class of file, so it means a regular file, and operations get out to read and unlink. This is a special rule because what is not an uncommon operation, it seems, is someone will boot an SE Linux machine with SE Linux disabled temporarily. So they'll use SE Linux equals zero on the kernel command line to temporarily disable SE Linux. They'll do some minor task, which may be fixing up a configuration error with SE Linux. Then they'll boot with SE Linux enabled again. And any files they created while SE Linux was disabled would have no label on them. And that includes /etc/mtab. So one of the first things as part of the boot up process is the mount wants to ring up the root file system read-write, and it means it needs to recreate the mtab file, and needs to be able to read it and unlink it. Since the mtab file will have no label, it will therefore have type file underscore c, so if missing the mount process, access to get out of it, so intercept the file, to read it, so it can read the contents, and then unlink it, so it can unlink the file and place it with another file containing the correct data. And then if there are any questions at any time, just raise your hands and I'll take them as we go along. Yep. The question is, wouldn't this rule allow mount to unlink any file? The answer is no. File underscore C typically applies to only files that lack the security.selinux, etc., which is used for SELinux labeling. So this file has no label, and there'll be generally very few files that have no label. If you have a large number of files that are unlabeled, then you have a more serious problem. And if it doesn't support labeling, such as an example is NFS. The NFS file system type doesn't support labeling because there's no way in the protocol, NFS 3003 protocol, for the server to export labels to the client. And we've got what we call GenFS configuration. And it's a generic way of labeling file systems. So in the policy configuration, we have a rule saying that the file system type NFS is going to have the SLinux type NFS underscore T. And that means every file, directory, symbol, etc. on an NFS mount will have type NFS underscore T. And in this case, mount has no access to those things. The only access it's given is access to search through the directory so it can mount NFS possible but not NFS. So in this case, mount underscore T will get very little access. What it would likely get, it would likely get access to a lot of files in the lost plus found. So I expect that when you have a file system consistency error, and files get unlinked and put in lost plus found, it seems fairly likely to me in some cases files will lose their exata, or maybe had no exata in the first place, or maybe the files are just created out of fragments. And in any of those cases, you might have no label on them. So in that case, I might not have access to these files. But mount is a fairly privileged process. If you can exploit mount, you can probably own the system anyway, so I think it's really a serious issue. Now, in the example, the policy. I use the word domain in capitals to represent the source of the operation. That can be the name of a single domain. It can be a name of an attribute representing zero or more domains. As mentioned before, if an attribute represents zero types, then the compilation process just removes it, discards as a null operation. You could represent many types, of course, or you could have a list of domains. So in the SELinux policy language, the curly braces represent a list. You can have nested curly braces, so since you have a macro representing a list, so you have a list inside a list. And so you can have a list of several different domains and attributes representing zero or more domains. Now, the type is the type of the file system object or the domain or process being acted on for an inter-process communication rule. The list and attributes work in the same manner as they do for domains. So you have an attribute representing zero or more types, you have a list of attributes, a list of domains, or a list of domains and attributes. The class describes the category of the objects. The most common ones are file, directory, or dir. LNK underscore file for symlink, CHR underscore file, and BLK underscore file for character and block device nodes, SOC file and FIFO file. They're the ones that apply to files on disk. Also about other object classes such as process for inter-process communication and security for interaction with controlling SMS itself. For classes, again, you can have lists. So you might permit an operation on both a file and a directory. Usually in that case, the only operation you're permitting would be get header, because for file and directory, you have very few operations that are in common. However, you could permit an operation to be permit an operation on both character files and block files at the same time. So you might permit rewrite permissions to character files and block files of a certain type. Now, when you define roles for user sessions, there is no actual declaration of a role, unlike types. So you just say the policy is role, the keyword role, and the name of the role, such as user underscore r, types, keyword, and then a list of one or more domains that are committed to exist within that role. So the first such rule that references the name of a role will define that role to exist. So the two examples are a declaration of the system underscore r role with a domain syslog d underscore t. So the syslog d underscore t is the domain used for the syslog d process. It's a daemon, and daemons run the system underscore r role. And now we've got the second one is the domain user underscore t, so used for user processes. It's in the role user underscore r. One thing to note about roles is when you load nested Linux policy into the kernel, the kernel will report the statistics of the policy. So it'll tell you how many identities, roles, domains, etc. are defined. And one thing you'll note is the number of roles defined according to the kernel is one greater than the number in the policy source. The reason is there is a special role, object underscore r, that is used for files and regular files on disk. And this role is different to the other roles and is actually automatically generated by the policy compiler and is not accessible to you directly. It's just used as a sort of placeholder because at this time, the role has no bearing on regular file operations. So file operations only the identity and the type actually matter. At some future time, the role may be used for file access, but it hasn't been used at this time. So object underscore r is a placeholder that's automatically generated. Now, to define a user identity, you have the user keyword, then the name of a user, which could be root, for example, then the keyword roles, and then a list of one or more roles. So you have a list in the usual list syntax with curly brackets. So we have two examples on the screen here. User JDoe, which only permitted to use the role user underscore r, and user JAdmin, administrative user, who is permitted to use the role staff underscore r, setup underscore r, and system underscore r. System underscore r means that that user can start a daemon, have the daemon automatically transition to the correct context, which means having an automatic role transition. So the daemon starts and the kernel automatically transitions the context such that the role is the system underscore r role. This is used in Fedora and Red Hat Enterprise Linux for daemon setup with a strict policy. In Gentoo and Debian, things are done slightly differently, and there is a special program used to launch a daemon which changes the role. so there is no automatic role transition permitted, and so that the JMN user on a Debian or Gentoo system would not need the system underscore R role. Now, when defining identity, a very important thing is you must list that the role will be the default role first, because this file, the file that defines the user identity is the file users. That file is both compiled in the policy and is also used by another program to generate the file labeling database. The file labeling database is a file named file underscore context. There's a list of regular expressions and SLMS contexts. And so go to every file in the file system when you label it, run by a program called setfiles or a program called restorecom. And these programs go through the part of the file system and apply regular expressions to each file name. And the last regular expression that matches will then indicate the security context to apply to the file. And so we want to have the correct context for that user's home directory applied. So we need to make sure you have the right role listed as the first role. One thing to note, there was a bug in the program that does this in Fedora Core 2, which meant that you had to have curly braces around the roles, even if there's only one role. That bug was fixed in Fedora Core 3, so you can have a role on its own without having a curly braces. Okay, there are a number of simple macros used for expressing permissions and accessing operations you might permit on files, directories, etc. So I'll just list a few of these permission sets. So one example is x underscore file underscore perms, which expands to get editor and execute access. R file perms, read, get editor, lock, and ISTL. So it's the basic operations needed to read a file. One thing to note, of course, is that ISTL might effectively be a write operation on device nodes. It's only on a regular file on disk that you can assume that ISTL doesn't actually change any data. RX file perms gives same as R file perms plus execute. RW file perms gives full read-write access to a file. RA file perms only allows... there's a bug in my notes there. RA file perms doesn't grant write access. The difference between RW file perms and RA file perms is that RA file perms doesn't grant write access, only append. Create file perms gives full access to a file. So every operation that might be committed on a file is committed in create file perms. And we've got some similar macros for directory access. We've got RDIR perms, which allows you to list the files in a directory, to search the directory so you can go to subdirectories or access files under the directory. And you can have get editor access so you can do ls-l operations in the directory. RW file perms allows you to create files or directories under the directory, but you can't delete the directory or move it to have a new parent. RA DIR perms allows you to create new files in the directory, but you can't unlink current files in the directory. And create DIR perms give you full access, so you can create the directory, unlink the directory, etc. Now, sometimes you might want to have access granted that is not quite within these ranges. So you might decide, for example, you want to have you want to have a directory that's only readable, but you can reparent it. So you want RDIR perms plus reparent. So you might, to do this access, you would have a list in your policy containing RDIR perms, which is itself a list, and reparent. So you grant that union of access. Now we've got a number of macros to control network access. So we've got an example is CAN Network Server TCP, which, as you'll probably guess, allows your process to act as a TCP server, so it can bind to a port and listen for connections, and then send and receive data across the TCP socket. CAN Network Client TCP allows a process to act as a TCP client and establish an outbound connection. CAN Network TCP allows both client and server operation. CAN Network UDP allows UDP data transfer. There's no UDP client versus server access, because the way UDP works is we don't distinguish between clients and server. We just send packets and receive them. CAN Network Server allows both TCP server access and UDP networking. And CAN Network Client allows TCP client access and UDP networking. One of the aims of writing these macros is to make things reasonably clear when you're reading the policy. So if you read the policy, you don't want to see a bunch of direct rules applying to TCP and UDP sockets, because that will take a little more time to review, a little harder to determine what the policy is actually doing, and therefore increases the chance you make a mistake when reviewing policy and have some policy in there that's not appropriate for your needs. So I think the clearer the macros are, the less chance of making mistakes and possibly weakening your security via mistakes. The two most common network classes that we use are Unix Stream Socket and Unix DGRAM Socket for Unix domain access. These are used much more than you might imagine, because they're used by a lot of library calls. So often programs will be doing Unix main sockets interaction with themselves, even though the author of the program is not aware of this, and you as the administrator aren't aware of this. You just start writing policy for programs in Linux. The way you normally start is you define a domain for the policy, and you write a policy to allow an automatic domain transition, so when you run the program, it runs in the domain you desire. So you run it for the first time, and then you see what it tries to do. And so normally when you do this, you run a program, and it's immediately aborts an error about something you tried to do that you couldn't do. Then you read your logs, and you find out what it was trying to do, and decide which of the things it was trying to do are appropriate. Because in many cases, programs will try to do things that they've got no good cause to do. And you just got to put in a don't audit rule so you just don't see any message of them. One example of this is a process that tries to access the UTMP file. In the library calls to access the UTMP file, it seems that they all will try and access the UTMP file read-write first. So they'll try and open the file read-write. If they can't open it read-write, then they'll try and open it read-only. And which seems a little silly, because most processes access the UTMP file only to read it. So they'll try accessing it by write, so you put in don't audit rule for that, and then they just happily fail on the first attempt at opening it, open it read-only, everything works, and they're happy. So often you have to think for a bit to work out what the correct thing to allow a process to do, because we don't want to allow every process that tries to write some UTMP file to do so, because obviously a lot of them don't need that sort of access. And so then you have to identify the other type of access to things that the process really needs to do. And this is generally identified through just knowing what the program does. If, for example, we have a daemon that's a DHCP server, for example, what a DHCP server has to do, it has to listen for broadcast network packets and send back a raw packet in response. So it needs raw network access. So you see a DHCP server you're writing new policy for, abort because it's not being an error message about, an audit message about not having raw network access. You know this program should be allowed to do that. So you then write the policy to allow that access, and then run it again and see what happens. Which would normally mean it will go one step further, and then abort on some other issue you haven't granted permission to do. Sometimes you have to run a program about 10 times to exercise all the areas to find out what it really wants to do before you've got the policy written. Now, good question. The question is it possible to have a policy where the program isn't stopped from doing what it wants to do, it just has the items logged? There's a couple of issues with this. Firstly, the thing is, when you permit operations that might otherwise be not permitted, you don't only permit those operations, the ones you're thinking of, you permit the ones that they would then allow. So, for example, you allow access to a directory, you're allowing access to all the files under that directory. So one example is, if a process does an operation equivalent to PS, so it wants to see information on all processes, for an administrator, you want to run PS and see every process. That's not the usual case. The usual case is a process wants to run a PS operation, or maybe launch a shell script that actually calls PS. They don't want to see every process at all. They want to see the four or five processes that are related to them. So you might have, for example, an APM daemon wanting to shut some things down before your machine goes to spin mode. So it wants to look for those daemons that need to shut down or other processes that need to signal, but it doesn't want to look through an entire list of processes. So what you would do is you have a don't audit rule saying don't audit search access to directories of the type domain. So it means any time it tries to search a directory under slash proc, apart from the types of processes you want it to interact with, then it'll just be stopped at trying to explore the directory, and that'll be okay. And PS doesn't even report any error message or anything like that, because it's an expected thing, that security measures will stop PS from seeing more processes. So if you were to allow all operations, you allow PS to search by those directories, then suddenly you get a slew of audit messages about access to files in those directories, which you previously hadn't seen. So you permit one level of access, and then you're just allowing a host of others. Now, of course, you're probably thinking, I could just have a don't audit rule, specifying that don't audit access to these files as well as directories. And that's not too hard to do. However, that means you're adding an extra don't audit rule, and I think that most people writing policy would not have a level of understanding and be meticulous enough to say, okay, I'll put in this don't audit rule while I'm developing, and then I know I can delete it afterwards. And the result is you get an extra don't audit rule that's not needed in the actual policy that gets delivered, and that expands the size of the binary policy, which incidentally is stored in non-pageable kernel memory, uses more of this memory, which is effectively gives the same result as taking some memory from the machine and slowing the machine down. On small machines, this can be a bit of a problem. One example I found was that I tried to run, I've got a machine running SE Linux strict policy on Red Hat Enterprise Linux 4. And the machine has 64 minutes of RAM. Now, Enterprise Linux 4, all documentation says you must have 256 meg of RAM to run it. And when you actually boot the machine up, it gives you a warning message saying, you don't have enough RAM to run this. And it pauses for a while to make sure you see the message, so it's a fairly serious warning that you're supposed to use such little RAM. But I wasn't going to buy a new machine, so I kept going anyway. So I used the strict policy, and my machine ran out of memory during the boot process and had the out-of-memory kernel code killing my init scripts, and the machine couldn't even boot. And this is because the strict policy was big enough that it took enough memory that the machines couldn't boot properly. So I had to then go and edit my policy and cut it down in size, as well as changing the init scripts to run swap-on at the first available moment so that I could actually boot the machine up. Obviously, this is not a usual case at all, but just to illustrate the point that you really want to keep down the size of the policy, and I think that some methods you might use of developing policy, such as developing in permissive mode, will lead to writing big policy and cause more of these problems down the track. So also in terms of granting wide access, there's two ways you can conceivably do this. One way is you could have some fairly permissive allow rules, and then have an audit allow rule. So audit allow rule means you want to audit an operation that's allowed. Normally with SE Linux, by default, every operation that is denied is audited, and every operation that is allowed is not audited. So you've got a don't audit rule, which means to not audit an operation that's denied. That's the case where a program repeatedly tries to perform an operation that we know it's going to try and perform. We don't care about performing, it doesn't really mean much, so we just want to keep the logs clear. And we have a audit allow rule, which means we've already permitted an operation, but now we decide we want to have it audited as well because it's important to us, which could mean that we want to audit it because it's a great security importance to the system and it belongs in the logs. For example, loading a new policy or changing a Boolean, these are very security relevant, and therefore we want to log these things because it's part of the information on what the system's doing. And the other category is, we've got something going wrong, we're not quite sure why, so put in some audit allow rules as part of a debugging measure to find out what's going on. And this could be for debugging SE Linux policy or debugging applications in general. And sometimes you have an application, you don't know what it's doing, and so one thing you could do is you could run GDB or S-trace something on it. Sometimes you have situations where a process is launched from a daemon, and the process runs for about a millisecond before it exits, and you don't know why it's aborted. It runs so fast that debugging is kind of difficult. The daemon does a million different things, and so debugging or running GDB on all its child processes will also become difficult. So in that situation, it can be kind of difficult to work out what's going on. So we can put in some SE Linux audit allow rules, and then SE Linux will tell us about what it's accessing. So one thing you do in running policy, you could conceivably have allow rules allowing access to file underscore type and domain attributes, so it allows access to everything, and then have audit allow rules in the same, and then see what it does. This means you can do this development in enforcing mode. The other option is using permissive mode. Permissive mode is a mode of SE Linux where SE Linux doesn't enforce its decisions. So if an operation is to be denied, SE Linux will log the fact that it's going to deny an operation, it doesn't actually deny it. The operation still proceeds. So this can be used for development. But as I mentioned before, I don't think this is really the way to go. So I think in most cases, the best way to develop policy is just to write some policy that matches what you believe the program's going to do, run the program, and then see what happens. For some programs, this might not be so effective. For example, if you have a program that's going to run for a long time before it gives a result, maybe it'll take a long turnaround time. If you wanted to, if a program did some certain operation after running for an hour, you might not want to run the program for an hour, then get information that SELinux denied it doing an operation, and then have to run for an hour again. But in most cases, such as setting up a daemon, you set up a daemon, and within a matter of seconds, it'll be doing what it's doing. And so you run it, either it works or it doesn't. If it doesn't work, then you look at what's gone wrong and then change appropriately. Also, one thing to mention at this stage is the issue of error conditions. If you're going to test the policy fully, you'd want to test what happens to the daemon in error conditions. Although for most daemons, for the standard SELinux macros permit logging via syslog by default, and generally you'll have custom logs for daemons as well, which you'll have policy for, and generally this will cover the error conditions. There are some programs which are a little more complex. One example is PostFix. I had a lot of work to get PostFix policy fully written, because it's so complex and so many corner cases. Corner cases such as if you've stopped PostFix when there's messages in the queue, and then you stop it for long enough that those messages expire through being in the queue too long, and then you start PostFix again, PostFix will behave differently than if it had been running all the time. So a different PostFix program will be used for the process of expiring the mail than it would be if it had been continually running. A little corner case like that made it a little more tricky to write the policy. Which I guess is another thing perhaps worth keeping in mind if you're writing a daemon, is to try and make access as regular as possible. So it means whether it's people using SELinux or other managed access control systems, really just doing a lot of tests of the program, make sure that all cases are covered. Alternatively, the issue of security holes. You want to make sure the program runs in a regular manner, and the same bit of code does the same task every time. If you have different bits of code doing the same task, maybe one bit of code has a bug that you haven't discovered, and then someone tricks a daemon into running a buggy bit of code, and you're compromised. Okay, now, do you have any more questions at this stage? Okay, back to worm ports. So when a daemon's listening on a port to write the service, you want to define a type for the port and to only allow that daemon to bind to it. So the syntax is using portcon keyword, then the name of the protocol, so that will normally that'll be TCP or UDP at this stage, the number of the port, then the context. And context will always start with the entity system underscore U, which is generally used by all files in the system as well. Object underscore R is the role. As I mentioned before, is a special placeholder role because role for such operations doesn't matter. And then the type that's used for port. One thing to note about port types is that once you've defined a type for port, it will not only prevent other daemons from binding to the port if they're being cracked, for example, or for other security issues, it will also prevent daemons accidentally binding to the port. When a daemon is offering an RPC service, what it will usually do, it will start at a port 1023 and try and bind to that port, and then work down a port at a time until it finds a port that's free. One time I was running a regular system, and I had a daemon offering an RPC service, got down to port 631 before it found an open port. Port 631 was the internet printing port. And so this daemon would have liked to have bound to that port and prevented me from restarting my print server. Fortunately, I was running SELinux, and I had a port context defined for that port, and so SELinux prevented binding to that port, so port 630 was used for that service, and everything worked fine. So in this case, this wasn't necessarily... We could debate about whether this will be a security issue or not. One point of view is someone's trusting this process with their printing data, and expecting it only goes to a printer, but instead it goes to whatever this other program was, and therefore their data is being hijacked, so you would say it's a security issue in that regard. But generally I think of this as just a configuration problem. This is a problem of just a program just being arguably buggy and doing something that the administrator didn't desire, and this Linux just happened to enforce correct behavior, which is binding to a port that won't pay any use for anything else. So an example of the now for the policy for allowing binding support, you've got allow rule, then the name of the domain, or again a list of domains or attributes, then the type of the port, then the object class, which is the protocol of the port, and the operation name bind to actually allow the binding. So a sample of this policy is allow slapd underscore t, which is the domain for the LDAP server, open order, the port type LDAP underscore port underscore t, the object class TCP socket, because LDAP doesn't support UDP, and the operation name bind. So that means the slapd can bind to port 389. And so generally you want to have every well-known port that a daemon is going to listen on your system have a type assigned to it. And one thing that's been considered is to have a policy define types for every well-known port that might be used by daemon which a policy have been written, even if you haven't at the time loaded in policy for that daemon. The idea being you've got a system that's been running for weeks or months or something, and suddenly you decide, I want to now run a LDAP server. And what you don't want to do is say, I want to run the LDAP server, and then you discover that the LDAP port has been used for an RPC service for the last month, and you've got a machine or your network connecting to it. That's not the kind of surprise you want. So it would be kind of ideal to have the port already reserved beforehand, even if you haven't got the policy loaded. That's a change we'll have to make sometime in the future. Okay. Often, we're talking about Linux, people have expressed concerns about how hard it would be to analyze policy. I mentioned at the start of the talk about 300,000 rules, and people get worried and say, how can you ever be sure of 300,000 rules? How are you going to be sure it's going to be doing what you want to do? My first response to that is always, on a minimal install of a modern distribution of Linux, you're looking at about 140,000 files. How can you, and each of these files affects your security policy. How can you be sure the 140,000 rules are doing what you want to do? And also, for the Unix permissions, there is no good tool to analyze them. For Easter Linux, there's a tool called APOL to analyze the policy, and there's also assertions. So for the I'll talk about APOL later. For the assertions, the syntax is never allow a domain access to a certain type or list of types, object class, and then operations you don't want to allow. Now, if there is an allow rule in the policy that conflicts with this never allow rule, the check policy program will refuse to compile it, because it can't be compiled, it can't be loaded in the kernel, as if the policy can never be used. So if you try to allow something that's grossly bogus, such as, for example, allowing user underscore t white access to shadow underscore t file, then your policy will not compile, because that's obviously an error and not something you want to allow at all. Now, a common feature of using assertions, a common feature that's actually valid right throughout policy, but apart from assertions is almost never used, is the logical not operator, which is you use the tilde character. So an example is tilde, then list, domain, and unlabeled underscore t, means every type that is not a domain and not unlabeled. And so that means every type used for regular files. And another feature that is often used in assertions, can be used other places but usually isn't, is a logical subtraction. And that means you have, so example below is we've got domain minus auth write. This is the set of types with the domain attribute minus the set of types that have the auth write attribute. Now, it could be that there are some types that have auth write but not domain. That's not a problem. It could be that there is no type that has both domain and auth write. So domain and auth write could be referred to as disjoint sets of types. Again, it's not a problem, not a bug at all. But in this case, auth write only refers to a subset of the domains, and it is domains that are permitted to write to the shadow file directly. So this rule is saying never allow a domain that doesn't have auth write access to shadow underscore t type for object class file, So that means /etc/shadow. Operations are file perms. So not file perms means a set of operations that are logically equivalent to a write. That means write, append, set header is ch mod and ch own, relabel from and relabel to. So we can't label get another file and label it as shadow_t and make it perhaps be an imposter for shadow file. And we can't relabel shadow file from shadow_t to another type that might be readable by our own process. So this is so the point of this rule is that every process that is permitted to the write to the shadow file will have this attribute in its definition. And so we can easily search for these attributes, so for example, grep for it. When you're writing policy, you're not going to accidentally permit access to shadow file, either directly or through a user attribute by mistake, because you have to go out of your way to add this authorized attribute in. And because of the importance of this attribute, you would hopefully think very carefully before adding this attribute and realize that this is something you often don't want to do. And in most and so the way this assertion rule would normally is used is someone will be writing policy and I'll use a tool called audit to allow. That takes a list of audit entries referring to program, things, operations the program tried to perform but was not permitted to perform, and produce policy allows them. So run audit to allow across the logs, get a list of accesses and a list of allow rules for them. They'll quickly look through them, we hope. Often they don't, but we hope they look through them. And perhaps they decide that they don't see anything really bad, so they want to load them in the policy. They try to load them, and the policy compiler aborts and gives them a message. I think, well, maybe I've done the wrong thing. And maybe I should remove this rule, because maybe the person who wrote the assertion rule knows more about writing policy than I do, and I should just assume they know what's right to do. That's what we hope, anyway. Okay, as I mentioned before, by default, every operation that's denied is audited. Every operation that's permitted is not audited. I explained the syntax of the allow rule before. I also have an audit allow rule to audit operations that are permitted. One thing that you've got to remember, which a lot of people seem to forget, is that audit allow does not permit an operation. The reason for this is often you'll have several rules allowing certain operations. Maybe a dozen different allow rules allow access for a domain for different types. And you want to decide you want to audit things to perhaps track down some, diagnose some problems. You don't want to go through the policy and work out which of these dozen things might be appropriate. Just put in a big audit allow rule, so audit allow access to file on support type. So then you want to audit every access to every file and system. And so if operations permitted, it will be audited. And you have to think too much about, you know, which things you're auditing, because it doesn't matter and you're not actually permitting any extra access. You're just auditing things that are already permitted. And if you've got an operation that's formed all the time that isn't relevant but is not to be permitted, you have the rule, don't audit. It's the same, again, same syntax as the allow rule, and just a different keyword. One thing to note when we're talking about audit is that if SE Linux, Unix permissions don't permit an operation, then SE Linux will never see it. The SE Linux kernel code will not be called if Unix permissions deny an operation, in most cases. There are a few cases where SE Linux code gets called first due to the way that the kernel code paths work. One example is binding to a port. SE Linux gets checked first for some reason. But in 99% of operations, and it's all file operations and disk operations, Unix permissions are called first, and SE Linux will never see an operation if Unix permissions deny it. Okay, I'll list a few important domain types. Yes? Okay, the question is how to handle audit overflows. The way information used to be logged was through basically through print Ks. So the kernel message interface, as used by KLogD, would get all the audit information. KLogD would then forward it to syslogd. Syslogd would write to a file as appropriate. There's been a recent change. There's a new kernel audit subsystem that's designed to handle audit data at a much higher volume than the kernel message log. And you've got an audit daemon which takes the information and then writes it to a file. I think the audit daemon has some sort of high bandwidth pipe to the kernel, like reading large chunks at a time instead of reading by small chunks. And I think there's some facility for the kernel to block operations if the audit process can't keep up. But I admit I haven't looked in that detail, but I believe that the audit system will solve these problems. Audit system is designed to have much higher bandwidth than the SELinux system needs, because with the audit subsystem, you might want to audit, for example, every file open of a process or every file access. Whereas the SELinux system, you open the file and you'll be audited if it's appropriate by policy. Yeah. So if you have audit allow, you only get typically one audit from a file open, even if you have 1,000 writes afterwards. Whereas for the audit subsystem, you might be auditing every single write, and that's much more data. You have another question? Yep. 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 Okay. True. There isn't a good solution this way. And obviously, if you have limited, you have finite limits, if you can't notice something's wrong before your var log position fills up, then you've got a serious problem. In an ideal situation, you would want to have a big log position and a good system for log watching, which will SMS you, and you want to have work out something is amiss long before you run out of space, logged in, and then identify the user and lock them out. But I mean, this isn't actually an issue such. This is a regular Linux administration issue. You've got something strange happening to fill up the log files, and this could be non-SELinux at all. This could be just attacking a daemon, and the daemon's logging information when it's attacked. And so this is, we have some issue. Yeah? Nothing in the kernel code. The SELinux kernel code is only about enforcement of the policy. And so there's lots of other things that could be done. In this case, if you want to have that policy, what I recommend doing is modifying the watchdog daemon to do this. One thing that's been an item on my to-do list for a while is to modify the standard Linux watchdog daemon to have a shared object interface. So you write shared objects to hook into watchdog and provide extra functionality, one of which could be periodically running a statFS on certain file systems and then showing chain downs appropriately. What the watchdog daemon does, there's a device node /dev/watchdog or /dev/misc/watchdog depending on your device naming scheme. This device node, if you open it, you have to write to it within a minute or the kernel will reboot the machine. So you have a watchdog program which opens this device node, keeps it open, and then runs a set of checks on the health of the system.